Howdy, folks. If you're thinking of getting into wedding photography, or even if you're just shooting the occasional wedding, today we're getting into the gear you need to create incredible images for your couples. And we'll discuss how to get wedding clients to choose you over the competition right after this. Welcome to Camera Shake, where we bring you the insider scoop on all things photography and videography, giving you a unique opportunity to stay ahead of the curve. As always, I'm your host, Kirsten Nutz, and before we get into it, I've got one thing to ask of you. I've noticed that over 65% of our viewers on YouTube and listeners on audio are not actually subscribed to this channel. Well, you can really help us out by hitting that subscribe button, because it'll help us get even more amazing guests on the show in the future. It's just one click. It'll take a mere second. Thank you so much. Just click that, you know, click that button just right now. There, it's easy, right? Just subscribe, follow, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, now without further ado, let's give it up for today's special guest, the doggo and cat-loving Scotch aficionado from Down Under, the wedding expert, photographer, and a man who shares his Dutch heritage with myself. Give it up for Marcel van der Horst. Marcel, man, how are things?
Great. Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I mentioned the Dutch heritage. So I have a Dutch line in my family too. It's my grandmother's side of the family. We're Dutch. So, you know, always great to connect.
Yes, of course. Yeah. My family moved here from Australia over 50 years ago now. So a little bit disconnected now, but they come from Wassenaar and Katwijk. So, but I know the country well and love it.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So my grandmother's side were from Venlo, just on the, but close to the German border, I guess.
Ah, yep. Yeah. Yeah. We're the opposite side on the West Coast.
Yeah. Phenomenal. Amazing. I just drove through the Netherlands actually in August. So yeah, it's a nice trip just on the way through, but it was fun. All right. Yeah, so, Marcel, thank you so much for being on the show. I think we've got some interesting topics to cover this week. And we're going to talk about wedding photography, but we're going to very specifically talk about wedding photography in the context of maybe, you know, if there's somebody out there who either maybe just started shooting weddings or is maybe thinking about joining the wedding game and shooting weddings. So, you know, if you're listening, or if you're watching and maybe you're, I don't know, you're shooting family portraits at the moment, you're thinking, oh, maybe weddings might be a good idea. So we're going to basically jump right in. We're going to talk about gear, and we're also going to talk about, well, so if you decide weddings is a thing you want to do, like, how do you get started? How do you find clients? How does all of this work? So Marcel, I'm banking on your expertise.
Sure, ask away. I'm happy to expand on anything. And I've been in this trade for 16 years now, and I've been through probably every iteration of photography equipment you can imagine. And you know, the journey from crop sensor, 10 megapixel cameras to the latest and greatest, that's on offer now.
And, you know, we're talking about gear, but really, you know, when I look at wedding photographers, this is, I have, it really the utmost respect for a great wedding photographer. I think it's amazing, especially, you know, I mean, creating these sort of moments or capturing these moments and creating these images under the pressure that you're under during the actual wedding, because it's such a like finely timed procedure the whole day, really, you know, and you gotta create these amazing images, or you're able to create these amazing images. I mean, your photography is so it's actually like so cinematic almost, you know. And, you know, the ability to create photography like that under that kind of time pressure, how do you prepare for that? And what specific equipment makes your life easier or makes that possible in the first place? Let's start with cameras, for example. Like, how's that one?
Yeah, so with cameras, I have two camera bodies pretty much on my person all day. So I'll have one with a wide lens on it, and one with sort of either a medium telephoto or long telephoto. So that way I'm at the ready for a different situation at any one time, because I'm a prime lens shooter. So I don't have the luxury of having one body one broad zoom range, and then just be able to select whatever focal length that tells the story and shoot. I have, yeah, a wide and a tight on at all times, so I can have that cinematic approach where I can take an environmental photo of the scene that's presented in front of me, say with a 24 mil or a 35 mil, but I also have a 50 or an 85 mounted as well to get those reaction shots and, you know, tighter in the character that, you know, maybe the bride getting ready or something like that, or a groom having his lapel flower pinned on by his father, that sort of thing. So the bodies themselves have to be quite good and quite fast and quite responsive with good autofocus, because there are instances where things unfold in front of you, you have to be quite reactive to it. And if you have, you know, gear that's complex, cumbersome, difficult to use, and doesn't focus well, you're not going to tell that story properly.
Now, here'd be a question here for somebody coming from, let's say, an events background, right? So if you're an events shooter, you know, one of your standard lenses would be a 24 to 70, for example, or maybe a 24 to 120, something like that. What's the advantage of using primes or having two bodies with two different primes over something, let's say, you know, like a 24 to 120, something that gives you that range? What's the advantage of having two separate prime lenses there?
So in the event space, a 24-70 f2.8 or f4 is quite the staple, because you're often using an on-camera flash at the same time. But my approach when it comes to photography, I like to single out the subject from the background. So I use primes that have two reasons. There's the fast aperture to allow me to shoot in darker conditions without flash. So that might be, say, a bedroom or a hotel where a couple might be getting ready, and I can shoot at apertures like f1.8 or 1.4, even 1.2 if I really need to go that far. And then also, yeah, to single out the subject from the background is another reason why I use fast aperture lenses. And it sort of, I feel it elevates the photography a little bit more, where you can really get invested in the character when the viewer is looking at the subject in frame. You know, it makes the background fall off a little bit softly, and it just gives it a nicer look. That's my main reason why I've gone that approach.
And when it comes to primes, for instance, as a portrait photographer, you know, I love primes. Obviously, I use primes all the time, especially 85 is my go-to lens for loads of things that I do. But for somebody just starting out, would you say, let's say, you know, if you're looking at a prime like a 1.8 over a 1.4, because the price difference is quite dramatic between those two lenses, would you say that to start out, when you're first starting out shooting weddings, like a 1.8 would do the trick, or would you advise to actually bite the bullet and spend the money on a 1.4?
Yeah, all photographers will suffer this in their lifetime, and that's gear acquisition syndrome. So if you do start with a f1.8, yes, you will be able to do your job. You will be able to sustain a business with that lens, and you'll be able to create imagery just as good as someone else that might have an f1.2. But you will find, you will lust for that lens down the line. So if you're spending, say, $700 US on, say, an f1.8 prime, and then you get maybe 2 years out of it, you may have to sell that off for $400 or $500, and then you're going to put that $400 or $500 into a lens that's going to cost you, say, $2,000. And, you know, you could have maybe have spent that $2,000 in the first place and not have lost $400 or $500 in that process. So if I was to start from scratch, my advice would be is to invest in the best quality gear that you can up front. So that way you get more of a life out of it, because once you go to pro quality equipment, it's pretty much designed to work in the professional space and also last you a very, very long time.
So it's really all about future proofing, ultimately, if you can afford it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always hard when you're starting out. you know, you get money in from a job, and then you go, okay, I need to buy that lens, and then you invest in it, and it just becomes like a sort of a system that just rolls over time, and you start picking up all these little bits and pieces of things that you do think you need, and then as you get older and more established, you find yourself just needing less and less, but you do need that sort of robust quality. And if you want an elevated kind of work, especially in the higher price space, yeah, to have the nicer lenses is really good to have, and it'll enable you to shoot in lower light conditions and get that subject standing out in the frame a bit more. And I think you can, you know, charge more money down the line as well as a result.
I could absolutely, I can totally agree with that. I really have made that mistake many times where just, you know, especially when I first started out, I was like, oh, okay, I'll buy this thing. But this thing is much cheaper than that thing. Like, I don't know, a C-stand, right? I'll spend a little bit of money on this cheaper C-stand because what's the difference? And I did realize about 9 months later, the difference was when I had to spend the same money again to get another C-stand, you know. And, you know, especially with lighting, I find it's nuts how much money you can drop on stuff like that.
Yeah, I've felt the same way when it comes to things, even as simple as accessories like light stands. Because when you're in the heat of the moment, and, you know, I also dabble in the commercial space as well, to have those bits of equipment that fails you on the job, the cheap stuff is not going to last. You see a lot of these Amazon sort of white label brands that are coming up in terms of accessories, and they're just not built to sustain professional use. And you find yourself replacing it down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. I so many times I've done this. In terms of lenses, I mean, you know, I was in a lucky position that I could invest some money into Pro Glass really right from the beginning, more or less. And I have to say, I mean, I didn't buy them new. Actually, I bought them secondhand. But these lenses, I'm still shooting them where are we now? So 13 years later, I'm still shooting the same glass. It's probably time for an upgrade, really. But you know, they still work. And to be honest, that glass, that Nikon glass, you can drive a tank over these lenses, you know, and they'll still... Well, in fact, in many situations, that would have actually happened, you know? But yeah, they're really like indestructible, pretty much, you know? Also very heavy, but, you know. So let's say you've invested into decent Pro Glass, you've got some decent camera bodies, and you mentioned it earlier, autofocus is really super important in the wedding game, because there's really nothing worse than missing that, you know, that shot, like the first kiss or that kind of stuff. What would be your advice on like camera bodies in particular?
Yeah, at the end of the day, pretty much you can't buy a bad camera in this current sort of state. Generally, most bodies that you can get sort of in the prosumer range, and that might be sort of the $2,000 to $4,000 US range, will suffice for wedding photography. And when you shoot as much as I do, you find yourself, you will be changing that body over probably every 3 or 4 years, because you will get to a point where you've fired so many frames through it, it's eventually going to potentially, a shutter blind might fail, or, you know, the sensor might die. So you need to change it down the line. So there are, you know, really high-end top bodies, but I've found the sort of middle ground when it comes to the body selection is being more than enough for my use. And ones that have good video features inbuilt now are becoming less and less in price. So, yeah, I don't think it's a lot of sense to maybe spend $10,000 or $8,000 on a camera body when you have to change them over every 3 or 4 years. So, I do find in my case, I use the Sony A7IVs, which have been more than robust enough for professional use, and previous to that, the A7IIIs. And yeah, it still produced a very good image, the A7III. Their video quality is not as good as the A7IV, but in a photo sense, very, very similar.
That's actually, you mentioned video there. I mean, that's an interesting thing, because obviously with the vast majority of, you know, mirrorless cameras nowadays, and, you know, whether it's Canons or Sonys, or even Nikon, you know, the video abilities of those cameras has improved dramatically over the last 4 or 5. I mean, really dramatically. How much do you use those video features when you're shooting a wedding? Like, so what I guess what I'm asking is, are you moving towards like, is it almost like being a hybrid shooter at a wedding, or do you still have a dedicated videographer on the job?
Yeah, so the way I've set up my business, I've primarily been a photographer, and I have been all my career. And it was pretty much in around 2019 where the demand for combination photo and video businesses rapidly increased in this country. And I had a videographer friend that did some work for me, and he was quite green in the industry. But I said, do you want to jump on board with me and start shooting video with me? And as a sort of a 1-2 punch combination of photo and video together for a wedding, that slowly increased in popularity. Of course, COVID in 2020 and 2021 was a big problem here in Melbourne. We had the longest lockdowns in the world. So that put like almost a 2-year hiatus on the business. But as soon as we came back from that, it was super busy, and having that offering increase the revenue of the business substantially, because I would bring in this videographer as a contractor, and then I would provide a full service to the client. And to answer your question, I did outsource the video side of things, but I also found myself offering video that sometimes there is a request for me to shoot video as well. So there are times that I might be behind the camera for the purpose of video, but pretty much 99% of the time I am the photographer. I don't do the hybrid thing, because I feel like I need to be 100% sort of dialed into photography personally. There are some great up-and-coming photographers now that are doing that sort of approach, but I'm an all-in kind of guy when it comes to the photography.
It's really difficult, especially on the same job, to switch back and forth. That's what I find. You know, I do some video, but I just find purely from a headspace point of view, it's either, you know, either you're all in with the stills or you're all in with the video, you know, and it's a constant back and forth would do my head in, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and the franticness of a wedding, I think, doesn't really lend itself to applying yourself to do a good enough job in both spaces at the same time. I really do think, especially when you get to your higher pricing levels, is you want to be really attentive to what's going on in front of you, so that way you're at the ready at all times to capture those moments that some of them don't repeat.
Yeah, well, this is exactly it. And you know, I'm often asked, like, what is your nightmare scenario in photography? And I always think my absolute, utter, complete, and utter nightmare would be having to shoot a wedding on film. Like, personally, you know, it's this thing like where, like, somebody asks, like, did you get the first kiss? And you go, I think so. But you know, did you get the first dance? I hope so. I don't know.
Oh, no, right?
I have to wait and see. You know, when we get it back from the lab, or you know.
Yeah, having grown up on film through the 90s, yeah, I totally understand that. So I understand the approach to film and what's involved. And yeah, I would not shoot a wedding in this day and age. There are people that offer that alongside their digital services. But it's more buzzword and sort of trendy than it is to deliver a whole wedding on film these days. You can emulate it in post anyway.
It was a very interesting conversation I had with Jerry Bionis at one point. He told me that he just for fun and to switch things up, he went out and he shot a whole wedding on Polaroid
one day.
Yeah, like, respect. Risky, but hey, okay, you know. But yeah, oh, maybe that's what I'm gonna do. Fuji Instax. It's a great idea. Who's getting married next? That's what I wouldn't know.
If anyone's going to do it, Jerry's the guy to do it. Like I mentioned before we started here today, he's been one of my greatest inspirations when it comes to wedding photography. And my first mentorship was with him. And a lot of the lessons I learned even all those years ago, I think it was like 13 years ago now, I still apply to this day.
Fantastic. Yeah, Jerry's a phenomenal wedding photographer. It's very interesting, of course, having him on the show in the past. And if I remember what the episode number was, I will mention it. Otherwise, I'll put it there. If you're watching on YouTube, it'll be somewhere up there, wherever that goes.
and also a big inspiration for me was one of your previous guests, Joe McNally, as well. And yeah. His approach to lighting and story was amazing. And yeah, I used some of those lessons I learned through his books in my photography today.
Yeah, it's, you know, storytelling is actually, that's a really important aspect. And well, let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, you're telling a really important story for a lot of people, the most important story of their life, potentially, you know, that one day, the most important day of their life. And well, you can't really screw that up. So how much preparation goes into that beforehand? And I mean, I know I'm talking to somebody who shot over 700 weddings, so you probably do this like in your sleep, but how much actual prep goes into that day? And are there massive differences between different weddings, or do they pretty much all sort of unfold in the same way, in your experience?
I'm finding these days types of weddings and approaches to weddings is becoming vastly different now. A lot of traditions are sort of going out the window, which is totally fine. I love to see the fresh approach to weddings. You know, some people are ditching the very typical things that are expected at a wedding. So it's up to me to sort of capture those differences as well that make this couple unique. Part of my approach is to really find what drives them in terms of their love for each other and their passion for each other. And I try to work with either their venue or location shoot, something that's going to really connect with themselves as well. So that way, when they look back on these photos, the photos make sense and they connected to them as well.
That day in everybody's life, if you got married, if you're listening and you have been married, or you are married, if you did get married at one point, then I'm sure you understand how important it is. Now, you know, I remember a story from my own wedding, which I'm sure I've told on the podcast several times, but, you know, when I got married 7 years ago, and it was summer as well. So the idea was, oh, it'd be great. You know, hopefully fingers crossed the weather would be good. And, you know, but our wedding day, in August of 2017 was the wettest August day in 45 years.
Yeah. And I had that exact scenario actually, not long ago. So it's summer here in Melbourne, and typically at this time of year, when people set their wedding in a winery, they kind of expect it to be warm and beautiful and have gorgeous sunsets. But I had a recent occasion where it was unforecast. It just appeared out of nowhere, really. It rained all day, and part of being a photographer is you have to adapt, and you are hired to produce something magical for that couple. And we didn't have a sunset to speak of. So I had to adapt and create something that's special to them. And I always tell myself I need to come away from every wedding with what's called a wall-worthy image, which is an image that I feel is like almost like a hero image of the day, or something that might be worth printing big to put on your wall at home. And I don't necessarily mean the very typical just two people looking at the camera type of thing. I look for something that's quite artful. That might be small in the frame is often the case, but something that really is very highly curated in terms of the approach. So what I decided to do was, due to my experience, I have in my camera kit some plastic bags with bungee cords that I can put over my lights. So I have a video light and also a flash that I took outside in the rain. I had them bagged so I can leave them out in the rain. And I had someone come out with me that had an umbrella over me to mostly protect my cameras more than anything else. And the couple were under umbrellas. and created this amazing shot that they mentioned in both their review and also just an email to say thank you for everything. We absolutely love that photo because it was something that they did not expect, and yeah, created something exciting for them. And they got somewhat quite drenched in the process, but and so did I. But yeah, we come away with something really special, and they love it for that.
I think that's really the trickiest way to create something that's really unique, And it's interesting what you said a minute ago was that, a lot of people are throwing these traditions out of the window, which, at first, my first thought was like, oh no, that's going to be difficult. But then I thought, well, actually, that gives you a lot of opportunity to create unique imagery.
Yeah, timelines are, they're often quite compact and quite tight, but I'm finding people are ditching a lot of the formalities at receptions to focus more on the party. And my job as a photographer is to really show that excitement in the crowd and them dancing away and having fun. They're the photos that are quite valuable to clients, I think, rather than, the really traditional stuff like cutting the cake, for example. That's just happening less and less. And I connect with my clients many times in the lead up to their wedding. So not only during the process of onboarding them as a client, where I might ask about their journey leading up to the point of being engaged or planning their wedding, but also I'll get to know them a little bit more in the lead up to the wedding as well, to see what's valuable to them, what is the things that I really need to capture, and also get an indication of what excites them in terms of photography as well. They even link to me some previous samples of work that I might have done, so that way I can really make sure I deliver a product that is exactly what they envision and dream of.
Hey, let me just jump in real quick to tell you about the amazing sponsor of this episode, Platypod. Platypod offers innovative camera support systems designed to unleash your creativity. With their stable, versatile, and portable solutions, you can capture stunning shots like never before. And I'm not just saying that. As the host of the Camera Shake podcast, I can personally vouch for Platypod's incredible products. They've become an integral part of the show. In fact, I'm surrounded by various Platypod products holding up lights, cameras, microphones, and so on. It's really helped to transform the way I make the show and the way I shoot at home in the studio and on location. But don't just take my word for it. Explore Platypod's website at www.platypod.com to discover their range of products, including the Platypod Extreme, Platyball tripod heads, and the brand new handle, of course. Make sure to follow Platypod on Instagram and Facebook at Platypod Tripods for exclusive updates, tips, and giveaways. By choosing Platypod, you're not only investing in your photography, but you're also supporting the Camera Shake Photography Podcast. Thanks again to Platypod, our amazing sponsor. Platypod, where innovation never sleeps.
Because I was wondering about how much preparation goes into it. So even before the shoot, what's a typical process? Like, how do you have consultation meetings beforehand leading up to the actual wedding day, and how much do you plan that day out? Like, do you know literally minute by minute what's going to happen on that day?
Yeah, I'm a very detail focused person, so I will not only ask a lot of questions about who they are at the start of the transaction, but leading up to the wedding, I'll send them a very detailed questionnaire that will have them map out exactly what's happening through the day, such as ceremony time, reception time, that sort of thing. And that enables me to create a timeline. And if there's anything outside of that questionnaire that I don't understand or need more information on, I will reach out to them specifically and find out. Because I want to make sure that on the day I have this run sheet and I can refer to it quite easily, because I've put it into a format that I can at a glance see what's going on. So that way they don't have to think about anything themselves. So I will pretty much run the day in terms of time without being militant about it, but I make sure that they're ready on time, that the dress is on at a certain time, the suits are buttoned up at a certain time. So that way the day can be paced adequately, keeps the stress levels lower, and they don't have to worry about anything, and they just have to enjoy it. That's the main purpose of getting across all the details before the actual wedding day itself.
How often do things actually go 100% according to plan and sort of move smoothly without a hitch? How often does it actually happen?
It's actually pretty rare to be running perfectly on time. I have found myself more and more as time goes on, the more I connect with the clients beforehand and also sometimes other vendors like celebrants and videographers, things are, pacing themselves quite well. I generally find couples that have bigger wedding parties, they try to jam in too many formalities, too many events into one little space, that the day gets overly complicated. And once one thing runs behind, the whole day runs behind. So the simpler sort of weddings that are a bit more sort of grounded, they will run to time more than they will have the more complex, bigger events.
What's the most complex wedding you've ever shot?
This was a contract job for another business that was based in a different state, but I had a couple that spent, this is just on flowers and candles at the reception alone, about $80,000 Australian dollars, which is mind-boggling to some people. People will spend that entire wedding that amount and then some. And there was supercars delivering the groomsmen to the church, and there was four or five groomsmen and four or five bridesmaids as well. And it was a big day. There's just so many things going on. There was bands, there was DJs, there was singers and all sorts of things. So it was quite a long event as well. And I find I've had some weddings that have gone as long as 19 hours, the coverage, right from the morning to early hours of the evening, and almost nonstop too. Just simply because there was just so much dancing and things going on and people involved. It was quite the day.
I said, typically, how much of the day do you cover? I mean, I'm guessing, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm guessing, you probably start with the bride getting ready, I suppose. And then do you finish off when the dancing starts? Because then, just dancing for the rest of the night is going to, or how long do you normally go on for?
Probably about 80% or so of my wedding coverages are 8 hours in length. So I'd often spend generally about 45 minutes with the guys getting ready. If it's a typical sort of male-female type of wedding. I find with the same-sex weddings, the getting ready portion is a lot shorter because I don't put a lot of emphasis on that part of the day. And they often get ready together in a lot of cases. And then you would spend an hour or so with the girls getting ready as about a half hour window, typically before the ceremony itself. Ceremonies in Australia are quite short. The actual legal part only takes about five or six minutes, but the typical ceremony length is about 25 minutes, and then 15 or so for family photos, an hour or so for their photographic session, which, if it's at a winery, it's just a stroll through the grounds of the property. And then up to the end of the formalities is the most common sort of coverage. Formalities being things like speeches, cake cut, first dance.
Amazing. Cool. Okay. And then I'm guessing if somebody wants you to stay longer, they can just purchase that as an add-on, I guess.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for them to request extra hours after the initial booking, because once they've mapped out their timeline, they're going, I've spent a lot of money on the band and the DJ, so I might want to cover that sort of thing. There are occasions where couples might want to have a sparkler exit or some kind of ceremony on the end of the night, even fireworks to some degree I've seen as well. So they might want to have those special events captured, and they will add on extra time.
So we talked about some of the gear required in terms of like lenses and mm-hmm. camera bodies. I want to get a little bit into lighting as well, just mainly because I mean, personal interest. You know, I'm a portrait photographer. I use lights all day. I love lighting, yep. and that's what I do. But you mentioned earlier the advantage in shooting primes is that you can, you know, you get better results in low light situations, obviously, because you got wider apertures and so on. But how much artificial lighting do you use, and under what circumstances, and or are there particular specific circumstances where you would basically light with strobes, for example, or how does that work at a typical wedding?
Yeah, so I do have a lot of lighting that I do take with me to a wedding. You'll find, younger photographers, if you're listening, a lot of photography is or equipment is just in case. With weddings, you do need to have backups of some of your equipment. I've got most focal lengths covered. I've got two camera bodies. I do have some extra equipment at home as a just-in-case thing as well. If something were to break outside of the wedding or before it, I do have some other zoom lenses available at my disposal that I have purchased over the years, and also lighting as well. You can start off with as simple as just a speed light. Like I've just got a Godox V1S is a very typical way of getting extra light where you need it, because not every situation you're going to shoot without a flash, because some venues are just too dark to capture any kind of photography. So having an on-camera speed light is probably the first step I'd approach with purchasing lighting gear. But I will go to the extent in a lot of occasions to try to get my lighting off camera, because it's generally more flattering. It's more, it's probably different to what you would normally get with an on-camera speed light as well. So I have via radio trigger, sometimes flashes remotely located around the reception, especially around the dance floor. And because I've been working with a lot of videographers lately, I've started bringing on constant lighting as well. So that way that can be utilized alongside video teams as well. So there's no need to have multiple light stands dotted around the reception, which, when you mix drunk people in, becomes a hazard. And it's just more stuff to bring. With constant lighting, I find that's enough power to, lift those points where there might be a couple on the dance floor, the lights are on them, and I can expose for the highlights, wait for them to be in the right position at the right time, and then I really sort of be really concentrated on, okay, this is the shot where I'm going to get the best composition, where the lighting lights up their faces as best as possible, and that's when I'll click the shutter. And when I say constant lighting, yeah. I just bought myself one of the new small rig RC60Bs, which has been awesome. It's got an inbuilt battery, and I just pop that in the corner of the room, 60 watts of power, and variable color temperature as well, and so I can dial that into the lighting that matches the room. And videographers love me because I don't have flashes popping off all the time, and it just works hand in hand, and becomes a little bit of a dance when I'm working with videographers, but they do appreciate the constant light for sure.
That's what I like about the small rig gear. I'm using a 120D just here right now, although it's not battery powered, but with the 60Ds, that's just such an advantage. The fact that you don't have to plug them in anywhere, and you can just literally plonk them anywhere wherever you think they might be good, and you don't have to worry about power lines and all that kind of stuff. And again, in a situation where you have a lot of people getting more and more, what's the word, inebriated,
yeah.
Whatever the word is.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
it might be tricky to have like cables going across the floor.
Yeah, absolutely. And heavy light stands as well. So You want to avoid that where you can. That light is small enough to, you know, even use like a super clamp or something on a, you know, a DJ's lighting truss, or, you know, a, you know, door frame or something like that. So you can really keep it out of the way that way.
Can you remote control them?
Not at this stage, that one. There are some other lighting products on the market that do have remote control. Also, the lights that I'm using here are Rotolight Neo 3s. I sometimes bring those to weddings where I do need the remote control aspect as well, because I might have to put them in a location where I can't access them. And you can't have them running all the time because it might wreck the ambience of the space. And I generally only need them during formalities like speeches or first dance.
Small Rig does have an app that allows you to remote control the 120 that I'm using. But it's probably the most abysmal app I've ever seen. Like, Small Rig, what are you doing? Seriously.
I have heard that.
It really is. It's absolutely abysmal. Like, even, you know, I work with Constant Light all the time, particularly with Loom Cubes that I use a lot. And I have to say, the Loom Cube app is, it's beautiful. It's so easy. You know, it's so easy to, it connects straight away. You can have multiple lights connected. You can control them all individually or together or whatever. I mean, it's just so, so easy. You know, and that's how, that's really how it, so Small Rig, honestly. Forget it. The lights are very good, you know.
I do also work with, in the commercial space, the Nanlite Forza range of lights, which also have quite a good Bluetooth remote control app. So you can create groups and also scenarios. So you can build, you know, multiple light systems. So if you want like a talking head sort of situation, yeah, you can rig up a key light, overhead light, that sort of thing, and map them out and control each one individually, which is cool. But when it comes to flash at weddings, I generally have, yeah, on-camera speed light. And if I have a remote control speed light or, say, a Godox AD100 in the corner of the reception, I can control power levels at camera level, right on the back of the camera. So that way I can work on the fly. But yeah, working with video teams a lot, I've found the constant lighting is good to have. And yeah, I just find that balance that suits sort of everyone. And yeah, it's I reckon created a really nice dimension to my speech photography. It's very hard to translate a speech in a photo sense because it's just someone speaking on a microphone. But I generally look for little reactions and little moments between the people that might be speaking and the couple. So I often sometimes even light the couple sitting down at their table as well. So that way I've got a lot of variety in the final delivery of photos as well.
And the other thing in terms of lighting, for example, I think that I always think is important and people don't necessarily think about in the very beginning. To invest into a lighting system that's sort of a, you know, comprehensive, what's the word? You know, a lighting system, literally, where you can have multiple lights working together off of the same trigger, for example, rather than, and this is, you know, so again, this is a mistake that I made in the beginning. You know, I think my first flash was a Nikon SB900 or something like that, or 910 or whatever it was, that was excruciatingly expensive. And then when I figured, I might need a second speed light, I went and I bought a cheap, whatever it was, Yongnuo or something. But of course, you know, these lights don't really communicate, you know, with each other. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with three speed lights. They were all three different brands and, you know, had to manually control. It was a pain in the neck, basically. And I think this is the thing to look out for is that, you know, if you are thinking of investing into lighting, you know, go for something that's an integrated system. Like Godox is a really good brand. I think it's very good bang for the buck. This in the beginning, there's virtually no need to sell a kidney to buy a Profoto rig. You know, something.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I have found the Godox, yeah, to, like you said, good bang for your buck. And it has proven itself in the field as being robust enough to work in the professional sense. And that circles back to what we first opened with is investing in good gear to start with is really important if you want longevity out of it, because there are going to be times where light's going to be knocked over, dropped. You'll even drop it yourself over time. You know, when you're shooting 50-something weddings a year, sometimes back-to-back, sometimes you get very relaxed when it comes to handling your equipment, and there might be assistance that you might be working with. You need to make sure that it's robust enough to work in that professional sense and last the distance. Have alternatives available in case something does break down at a wedding or leading up to a wedding, or if you have a back-to-back wedding on a Saturday and a Sunday and something breaks on the Saturday, that you've got something available to work with on the Sunday as well. So I actually have a dedicated room in my house that it's pretty much dedicated towards storing gear. It looks like a camera shop down there, but I have found over the years that I've needed lots of bits and pieces, and especially backups, so that way I can provide the best quality of service on the day for those couples.
Yeah, backups are important. You know, Godox, again, you know, just mentioning Godox, Godox has a great range. The 8200s are fantastic lights. They don't break the bank. You can basically, you usually just pick up a number of those. They're very flexible with lots of different heads that you could use. You can even, you get a head where you can clip two together and turn it into, you know, an 8400 effectively, you know, with double the power on it. This just, you know, very, it's a really flexible system. And sturdy enough, so you get a lot of mileage out of those. I recently traveled to Arctic Norway to teach a workshop out there with a whole bunch of Godox gear in my case, and it was fantastic. And we really put this stuff through the ringer. Like, we were out in, you know, in the Arctic tundra, shooting location shoots left, right, and center. You know, throw this stuff in the back of the van, drive to the next location, get the models out, get the gear out. Shoot all day, and you know, with the master classes, all sorts of different. I mean, I was really very, very impressed as to how well that gear held up. And you know, the thing I'm asked a lot is like, well, what's the point then in, like, you know, spending twice to about three times the money on things like Profoto or Broncolor? And then I always say, you know, look, if you find yourself at the point in your career where you travel a lot and you hire a lot of gear, it is a very worth it then to know your way around brands like Profoto and Broncolor, mainly because the vast majority, virtually all hiring houses around the world will stock these two brands. So no matter whether you're flying over to the US, or if you're not in the US already, if you're in the US, you're flying over to Europe, or, you know, if you're flying to Africa or Australia, wherever you may be, and you don't want to take, you know, half your house with you in terms of gear, you know, you fly to your place, you hire the gear in particular, Profoto and Broncolor, two very solid brands that you'll find all over the planet, really. And that's when that becomes very, very, very useful. But if I was to kit my own studio out with new lights, I don't really see the point in spending that amount, because it's a business at the end of the day. You know, you're going to, like, you know, the money you spend isn't free money. Like, you know, you're going to have to justify that somehow. You're going to make that money back. And then, you know, so I found things in this sort of range of the Godoxes in our world. Nowadays, I found them really reliable and actually very strong contenders in that, you know, in that sort of environment. Also, Godox are bringing out a brand new trigger. Wait for that to come. We'll be talking more about this on this show. In the not distant future, as soon as I can get my little fingers and hands onto one of them, it's on the way, apparently, they say.
Yeah, little trigger has piqued my interest. I've been working with Godox for years, and I do have the X-Pro 2 with the Bluetooth transmission in it. I do find myself using more of that in the commercial space, but the little compact nature of the new one looks good.
Yeah, it does look very good. There's some really nice nice features in there. I like the idea of a touch screen and all that. So it's going to be, it's going to be an interesting little thing. I'll definitely, you know, definitely feature that on the Camera Shake podcast. Because as I keep threatening on the show, you know, we are actually going to we are going to create some more product-centric bits of content in the not-too-distant future. So just wait for that. Anyway, okay, so we've covered the gear. Now, if you're out there listening and you think like, okay, well, all right, I've got the camera ready. You know, I can deal with the lenses. That's cool. The lighting, okay, I got a handle on that. All sounds good. You know, ready to go. But now I need some clients. How, especially when you're first starting out, how do you get yourself in front of potential wedding clients? And how do you, well, let's talk about that first. How do you actually get yourself in front of clients? And then we'll talk about how you stand out from the competition. But just purely from a practical point of view, how do you get yourself out there, and how do you land your first wedding client?
Yeah, there is a lot of people that have flooded into the market as wedding photographers. And from what I am seeing, they go in trying to sell themselves on price, but they really don't have the fundamentals of photography down. Before I started a wedding photography business, I was actually well practiced in photography anyway from a hobbyist standpoint, where I learned all those true fundamentals of photography. You know, I'm a very technical photographer at the end of the day, but I learned by making mistakes as a photographer back in the film days and the early days of digital. And I just practiced the pure fundamentals, what lenses do, what apertures do, all that kind of thing. I'm finding a lot of people that love the idea of photography or fall in love with the passion of photography. They think they can start building a business off that, but they am not well versed in dealing with the situations that you might face at a wedding, because being a wedding photographer, you kind of need to almost understand all aspects of photography. That includes portraiture, photojournalism, architecture to some degree, working in low light conditions, and just being an overall sort of people manager as well. And when people go sell themselves on price, you're just becoming the same as pretty much everyone else that's out there. So you need to present a product that's going to stand out and draw in those clients as well. And I feel a great approach for a new photographer getting into this business is creating styled shoots. And that can be as simple as grabbing two friends that are in love and saying, let's go to the beach or to a clifftop or go for a walk in the city streets and create some imagery. And that's where you can sort of learn exposing on the fly what apertures do, how to pose people. And once you've learned those sort of fundamentals, repeat and do that to a point where you can be quite confident in directing people, because you're going to come across every type of personality out there in the wedding industry. You're going to have people that are really shy in front of a camera, and it's your job to extract their personality. There are some people that will be just will almost refuse to be in front of a camera, and you have to make them feel comfortable. There are people that will pose for you and be, you know, ready to go and look perfect in every frame. But that's not going to be always the case. So you have to be very adaptable in that sense. And then once you've sort of got a folio sort of built in the style shoot arena, that's where you can start maybe offering your services to other wedding photographers, where you might say to them, can I come and carry your bag for free, you know, just to sort of see how a wedding day works. And that can be quite a eye-opener for a lot of people. I have mentored a few young people over the years where they have an interest, and I say, come and, you know, carry a bag for me one day. And I've done it in my past as well. That's a big foundation of how I started, was carrying bags for other photographers and learning what they did on the job. Take that knowledge and apply it to the stuff that you've learned with the practice shoots. And then you need to get your sort of branding in line, a website built, and start building an online presence. And Once you start going to weddings and maybe the second photography space where you might be shooting for other studios and whatnot, starting to build a folio, that's where you start to make connections with other suppliers, you know, take photos of those flowers and maybe the food or details of the dress, and, you know, maybe connect to those suppliers and just be an overall good human on the day and be friendly. And building a wedding photography business doesn't happen overnight. It took me a number of years. You can do it faster than ever now because there's a lot of training out there for that. But yeah, you have to really look at every aspect of the business, including how to run a business and your branding, your website, your social media, connection network, your systems and workflow. And yeah, over time, you just have to build that following and find whatever work you can. But I found through network and practicing with maybe couples or, yeah, just second shooting for other businesses has sort of trained me into what I know today.
But that's actually, again, that's really interesting. Building a portfolio makes perfect sense. You know, we need to display whatever it is that we're trying to sell. You know, we need to put that in the shop window. You know, of course, we're trying to sell hoovers. Yeah. Then we need to have some hoovers in the shop window. It doesn't make any sense to put, I don't know, cows. I don't know why I'm thinking of cows. Don't put a cow in a shop window if you want to sell hoovers, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
You know, so it makes perfect sense to build a portfolio. But it's, again, it's like you mentioned, it's really super important to remember that the wedding industry is exactly that. It's an industry, you know, that consists of a range of different suppliers, everything from the people that make the flowers, the venues, the food, even the hire cars, you know, the limos and whatever. I mean, anything and everything that goes into providing a service for that day, and photography is one of them. That's a great networking space to get to know people in that space in general, I guess.
Yeah, I can tell you that I don't invest a lot of time in social media, and there are photographers that live and die by social media and they will get 90% of their business through it. But I find I get most of my work, if not all, through network connections and being present on the internet as well, because investing all your time and energy into social media has a little bit of risk to it, because it's not your part of the internet. It's owned by someone else and they control the viewership and the rules around it. And you are at risk of getting hacked and removed. And, you know, there are other people vying for that customer attention. But if you have your own website, you can design it the way you want. You can attract the exact people that you want and build a following through that. And getting searchable on the internet is not as hard as what people think. If you have a valuable content engine that people are looking for, they will find it. And another important factor, I think, is back to the networking thing, is if I meet a limousine driver on the day, I will go up to them and I will shake their hand and say hello, just be happy and jovial with them, ask how their day has been. Even small talk like the weather just makes everyone feel at ease. And then once we're parting ways, I will say, and if the couple's happy with this, I will let them know. I'll send you some photographs of your car and the couple with the car. So that way you've got something for your content and they think that's the most valuable thing in the world. And when they have content on your website, on their website, they will go, oh yeah, I remember that photographer that took that. It was really nice. If a couple asks about a photographer, I might refer their name, for example. So, and I'm, you know, might get work from them. So that means I might refer work back to them as well. And it becomes a bit of a circle.
And that's really how it works in the commercial space as well. Is, you know, I find that I get a lot of work through commercial connections that I've made over time. You know, in my case, I very often work with AV teams, so companies that provide audio and video for conferences, for example. You know, and often there's a, you know, they book a client and there's a need for a photographer. And then, you know, I tend to, well, hopefully my name pops up at the top of the list, and then I usually get a call. And that's very often how it works. You know, I just actually just a week ago or so, I shot a job by the coast, which was through a video production company that I worked with a lot on different projects. And it was just the kind of project where they had a client. They were rebuilding a website. They were actually setting up a business and building a website. And they needed stills for their website as well as the video that they were producing. So it made sense for me to basically be there on that day when they were all together, you know, create some photography there. It was perfect. But that's, again, it's a B2B connection that actually leads to that job, rather than, you know, rather just putting your shekel out the door and hoping that somebody walks by and sees, oh, okay, there's, you know, Kirsten's wedding photography, which I don't really shoot a lot of weddings at all, but, you know, just as an example. So networking is super important. Do you think, is it worth displaying your work on like wedding fairs, for example? Would you say that's a good investment generally?
Yeah, I don't do the wedding fair sort of thing. That it does happen in this city, and also because Australia is made up of states, it does happen across the state as well. I generally find with the customer base that goes there is very price driven. So I tend not to be in the sort of cheaper space, so I generally don't go for them, and I'm still getting a sufficient amount of work through the referral partners that I have with, say, celebrants and venues and other photographers as well. I do have sort of a regular sort of array of photographers that I might refer work to when I'm not available for that particular date, and that usually comes back full circle as well, and has resulted in some great bookings.
You've mentioned social media mm-hmm. a minute ago, and I know that I think it's possibly a misconception, especially among people who are just starting out in the photography game generally, but potentially also in the wedding game, is to think that it's all driven by social media. And so, you know, you have to have the Instagram accounts and the Facebook pages and all that kind of stuff, and you need to invest a lot of time into creating content for it. And I know how time-consuming it is to create social media content. You know, it's one of these things. It's you can spend a big part of your week just creating social media content, you know, if you're not careful. But in your experience, like in reality, what percentage of your bookings are actually driven by social media or come through social media in reality?
Yeah, when I look at the metrics of the incoming links and stuff like that, it's still up there, but it's still largely from other suppliers. Because yeah, I managed to get myself on a couple of referral lists. From partner businesses and also SEO. That's why I kind of more focus on SEO, because you generally focus more energy to what is working for you. I just find with social media, over the years, even though I had less followers back then, the engagement was a lot higher. So in order to get more reach on social media, you really have to pay for that reach. And when you do pay for that reach, sometimes it doesn't really gain you anymore. So I find I just really sporadically post to social media, just because I do need to keep that going in a way. At the end of the day, the website is where it's at. That's why I invest a lot of time and effort into it. And it's definitely paying off, because I'm starting to find that I'm ranking for some really important search terms, which I think is driving a lot of traffic to the website, such as write-ups on venues and content articles like how many hours do you need a wedding photographer for? And I'm currently ranking between number 2 and number 3 on Google for that. So I know that content style of marketing is working for me. And that's I use those articles as well to help clients.
I think that's a super important point. Let's talk about that, actually. Let's drill down on this. First of all, I always think of the 80-20 rule. You know, if I can get 80% of the result with 20% of the input, I'm sold. I'll do it. You know, I really apply that to just about anything, you know, even when it comes to like this podcast, for example. You know, if there's a way that I can get to 80% of the result by putting in 20% of effort, then I'll do it. And that's good, because if you apply that rule across the board, you're actually going to get much better results on the whole. And it may be, you know, it may be automating certain processes or scaling certain processes down or changing certain processes, whatever it takes, you know, for you to get the result. But accumulatively, that will lead you to better results along, you know, further down the road, basically. That's what I've found. So you mentioned, you know, content-driven marketing in order to increase your SEO. What specifically are we talking about? Are we talking about blog posts, for example, or how do you approach that?
Yeah, so I have blog posts on my website, so it's a dedicated sort of page. And I have two main sort of directions where I have blog posts. So not only I have pictures from previous weddings where that might be a blog post that will talk about the day, have some photos of the wedding itself, but I'll put a bit more story into it. And that might include things like, what's a advice you would give other couples, for example, because I send this in the questionnaire, and I paste that into the blog posts. So that way it might be a question that might be searchable on the internet. So there might be another couple out there that might be searching for that particular answer, and having that content in that blog post might be valuable to them. But also there is things like links to the suppliers involved in the wedding as well. So when you have outgoing links on a blog post, and so, you know, of course, incoming links, you become, in the eyes of Google, a more valuable resource. So that way you get pushed towards the top of the rankings if Google feels that is a helpful article. So just by posting a whole bunch of pictures is not going to get you anywhere. But if you have some valuable stories or context to either the venue or the approach to that wedding, that becomes more valuable for people to read. And that's how I get eyeballs on those articles. But I also have help articles as well, such as like the one I mentioned before, how many hours do you need a wedding photographer for? It's quite a long, in-depth article. So it's got thousands of words in it, but it addresses that important question that when couples are planning a wedding, they don't actually know that. They often sort of see other people getting certain amounts of hours of coverage or photographers offering a certain amount of coverage. But because weddings are so varied these days, they really need to sort of see, okay, well, how many hours do I need for my type of wedding? So I've got a few like timeline samples in there, you know, sort of scenarios that might unfold through the day that they need to account for. And also whether if it's a male-female wedding or a same-sex wedding, how the approach might be different. And that's based on experience. And all those little things become a valuable resource to people that might be looking into that. And that's why I'm ranking quite well in that space. And another one that's doing well for me is a venue guide to a certain region that's near me. So we have a winery region in East Victoria that is a beautiful location, probably one of the most beautiful wine regions in the world, possibly, and has some award-winning wines that come out of it. And it's a very popular area, and I wrote an article that sort of encompasses all the main venues in that area with photos and samples, because I've worked in each and every one of them. And that's been a great resource that I've linked out to lots of people in Facebook groups and stuff like that. And that's increased its popularity. And when people search for a particular venue in that area, it's very likely that my article is going to get picked up and shown to them. And that, in hope, will connect me to new couples that are looking for wedding photography, because often the first part of a planning journey is selecting your wedding venue.
How consistent are you with the content? Like, do you produce new content every week on a weekly basis, or how much new content do you produce?
I will be very transparent and say it is not consistent at all. It's actually terrible. but when I do put effort into it, I go to the nth degree in terms of quality of content and make sure it's proofread really well, has all the incoming links and outgoing links all mapped out correctly. So that way it's engineered in such a way that it's going to be a good read for people, and that has the right search terms and tags put on it. So I do aim to output more during the off season, because weddings are very seasonal in my area. So I use the winter to generally push out more content. So I generally, just write a few articles, put them together. I've got an actual big list of things to address. The next article that I aim to put together is something about how to design wedding suits for the guys. So, there is a lot of unknowns out there for a lot of people, and I'm finding couples are investing more in the, what they're wearing on a wedding day, and it's good to maybe link to some suppliers that I've come across multiple times and do good work, but also just give little bits of information, such as why do we do certain things, like wear a buttonhole flower, for example. All that sort of stuff fascinates me, and love to talk about that sort of stuff. And if I can help a couple in making the right choices, I've done my job.
It's that and wedding dresses. I have to say, it's a huge, huge subject. I remember the whole. My own wedding was only 7 years ago, but I remember it very well. The whole, like, the year and a half leading up to it, our engagement rings were Haribo rings, which we ate eventually. So,
that's cool. I
can literally say,
I like unique things like that. Yeah, for sure. Back to that suit article, there are people getting louder sort of colors and more vibrance with them. So, I love to sort of create that almost encouragement or environment where, it's good to sort of express yourself as a wedding to make it more yours and rather than the same as everyone else's.
Do you find, is there a difference in terms of style between, like, let's say Australian weddings and, let's say, European, like maybe British weddings, something? Do you see a difference there?
Yeah, because of my Dutch heritage, and I've actually photographed a wedding in France before, the approach is quite different, mostly, how it's structured. When it comes to outfits, I don't think they vary so much, and also styling. Probably the Europeans probably put a bit more sort of emphasis on the look and the style. In Australia, especially in Melbourne, we're very multicultural, and in Melbourne and Sydney, there's a very big sort of LGBTQI sort of community as well. So you will see every walk of life in terms of how a wedding is structured and how it looks. And I just recently had a wedding on the weekend just passed where two girls had their wedding celebration, and one was wearing a pink pantsuit and the other a black jumpsuit with bright aqua patterns on it. And, they didn't need to wear big white dresses, and it just fitted their personality, and it was a fun sort of looking wedding and also feeling wedding at the same time.
Yeah, and something that makes for a unique event. That's the thing. If every
Same thing. Because it was more them, they probably would have felt out of place if they actually had the big long gowns or even a white pantsuit for that matter. I think it really sort of suited who they were and it makes it more authentically them.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, and the things, I remember like when, you know, my wife and I, when we were planning our race, you know, we were thinking about, okay, well, how are we going to, what's it going to be like, you know? On purpose, we came up with a thing that was like totally the opposite of who we actually are. But for us, that was amazing because it meant that we could step into a different world for a day, you know, and it was great for that. You know, we're pretty relaxed people just generally, you know, but I went, okay, I'm going to go for the all out like James Bond suit with the bow tie and that's, you know, and a cummerbund and that's what we're going to do, you know?
Yeah.
I've never worn this ever again, but it's great, you know, it's great for it. It's almost like an opportunity to dress up, I think, you know, which we loved and it was great. Also, our wedding got hijacked a little bit because the thing was, you know, in a former life, I used to be a musician. I always say this billions of times on this podcast. I used to be a musician. I'm obviously still a musician, but, you know, I used to be an active professional musician. And I always just say, like, I've played probably, I don't know, hundreds, if not thousands of weddings in my lifetime. And I like weddinged out, you know. But the truth of it actually is I actually love weddings. I love the whole procedural thing and I just like it. And it's nice. Yes, it's nice to see people happy and in love and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's always a privilege to be part of the special day. As a consequence, when we were talking about what kind of wedding our wedding was going to be, you know, I was like, well, I don't want it to be like a formal wedding kind of a thing, you know, like with a party and speeches and the whole thing. Like, I've done this too many times. So let's just not invite anybody. let's not even have a party. So I figured, you know, because, you know, my wife grew up in the UK. And so her parents now live in the UK, but she actually was born in Canada. And so she has lots of family. She's actually Canadian. She has a lot of family in Canada. And it turns out, that my mom's side of the family, who are also Canadian, live about a 45-minute drive away from my wife's relatives, which is, given the scale of the country, is quite remarkable. Sheer coincidence. And so we figured, you know what? What we're going to do is, and of course, I have family in Germany too. So we figured, like, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to have a barbecue over here in the UK with our British relatives. Then we're going to go to Germany. We're going to have a barbecue with my German relatives there. Then we're going to go to Canada and we're going to have a barbecue with our Canadian relatives. And that way we can involve them all, but we're not in a situation where we'll have to have like one big event and everybody's going to come here and fork up for flights and hotels and all that, you know. We didn't want to do that to anybody. So that was the plan, right? That plan worked well until all of our British relatives went, oh, party in Germany. Awesome. We're coming. And so it was like, what? Okay. And that's actually where it happened. So yeah, so we loaded up a plane and got the whole gang to fly over to Germany. And then it turned out into a massive, it wasn't even barbecue anymore. It was just getting ridiculous over there. But yeah, it was fun. You know, it wasn't planned, but it was still fun.
Yeah, I did have a lot of that post-COVID. There was a lot of people getting married overseas or have a symbolic ceremony overseas and they might have a party that they might have in Australia because they couldn't get everyone to their weddings. So it's I even had one couple that did their wedding celebration three times. So it's a fun sort of approach to it for sure.
As you mentioned earlier, you know, in Australia, when you guys had, you know, we had a massive time of lockdowns over here, but I know Australia opened up way after everybody else. In the rest of the world, so it must have been dragging on terribly for you guys.
And Melbourne had the longest lockdowns in the world. There was nearly 2 years of closures there, so it was a very stressful time for the wedding industry, including myself, because that was pretty much my full-time income. And I was just lucky to have a few clients on payment plans. So that had a little bit of money sort of dripping through. I also set myself up with a little bit of cash before it actually happened as well. So I had a little bit of padding because weddings are so seasonal in Melbourne that I need to have a little bit of cash padding through the quiet periods. So, and that's something that a lot of younger photographers might need to take on board is cash flow is something that's very important to running a proper business. So if you're constantly throwing money at gear when you're first starting out and not building sort of a financial padding for those quiet periods, you're going to get to a point where you're going to be starving, you know. And I learned that a long time ago when I first left my previous industry, which was in automotive electronics and sound equipment. And my first winter was basically scraping together change to feed myself. So, of course, I've put things in place as I've become more experienced and, a higher sort of earner now. It's something to really sort of think about when you're first starting out.
I think, taking classes in how to run a business is, no matter what, I mean, whatever you set yourself up as a business is absolutely essential. You know, I've fallen down that trap, you know, in the beginning. And I've learned the hard way, you know, and I think it's absolutely right what you say. It's really important to have some kind of, you know, a little bit of padding just to make sure you can get through the hard times, especially if it's seasonal. But also, you know, as far as the pandemic is concerned, nobody could have known that anything like this could actually happen.
That's the same thing when it comes to being a wedding photographer. You really need to be a people person. I used to come from a sales background, so I have had that ability to be personable with different personality types. And there are some people that photograph weddings that are quite introverted and, not the best conversationalists, but I find to really shine and, but not without being over the top as well, because sometimes as overbearing photographers, the ones that are over exuberant and dancing on tables by the end of the night is sometimes a little bit much. It's too much of a show, I feel. Part of being a wedding photographer is, blending into the crowd, but at the same time, having that command of, you know, if you're organizing family photos or group photos or whatever, that you can get all those people in the line. But at the same time, you can have just a nice chat to the couple's parents at the end of the night, thank them for having me at the end of the night and really leave an impression. That's how you're going to get those referrals because they remember, the experience on the day more so than the photos, because it's easy for anyone to achieve good photography now because the gear is getting cheaper and more accessible. There is more training available out there, but they're still going to refer on someone to maybe photograph a bridesmaid's wedding or a sister's wedding down the track when you left them with a good impression on the day itself.
And that's really that is so true, and it's really true in so many different ways. You know, whenever you work with humans, you know, with other people, you've got to be a people person, and that's true. You know, if you're doing headshots, portrait photography, you know, whatever it may be.
Yeah, in the wedding space, you are being let into a world that is very personal for family. You are getting to know parents of couples and sisters and brothers and their best friends. And you get to witness a world that no outsiders often see. So you just have to be an overall sort of nice person that's empathetic as well. And being able to recognize maybe the couple might need some space as well, because, you know, they will get to a point that they might be all photoed out. And I always encourage my couples to take 5-10 minutes out of their wedding day to take time alone, reflect on, you know, their journey up until this point or the words that they shared at the ceremony. And even when I finish their sunset photo session, I'll tell them, you go watch the sunset for another 5 minutes, or look back at your reception and all the people that are here to celebrate your day. And I walk away and leave them alone. And they find that the most memorable part of their day.
Actually, I remember two conversations that completely fit what you just said. One was with David Berkman, where we're talking about photographing Jon Bon Jovi. And I remember he said, you know, my ability is to know when to be in the room and when not to be in the room. You know, that's like, I'm really good at figuring out when to be there and document and take pictures and when to stay the hell away, you know, because otherwise you get into somebody's nerves, you know. And it's a very similar conversation I had with Pete Souza, who used to be Barack Obama's and Ronald Reagan's photographer. And of course, you know, there on the one hand, you've got this massive responsibility of documenting everything that goes on in the White House and around the president. But at the same time, you know, you need to know when to step out, you know, and when not to be there, because there are moments where it's important not to be there. And it's just knowing that, you know, and being able to make that connection on a human level, you know, and being able to emphasize with, you know, with other humans is super important. It's like you said, you know, in the wedding space, of course, I mean, it's somebody's special day. You don't want to get on somebody's day. It's like you said, I can imagine that the couple really needs to have these moments to themselves because it is their special day. And yes, you are there to document it, but, you know, there needs to be that little bit of space still.
Yeah, and they often look to a photographer for support and guidance because they haven't really done this before in the majority of cases. But, you know, I'm lucky to have that sort of window where I'm there for the longest period of time out of any other vendor. So I get to see every sort of aspect of the day. And, yeah, if you can just be a good calming presence and sort of guide them through what needs to happen in terms of timing and getting the best out of them for their photos as well, they're going to really appreciate that. And you can have whatever sort of gear that you have, but yeah, if you are a strong support for the couple and you know, leave a good impression on the day as well, you're just going to get booked.
Marcel, as a final tip for anybody who's thinking about getting into the wedding photography business, give me three things that somebody would need to be able to master in order to make it as a wedding photographer.
Yeah, probably the first thing I'd probably consider is really learn the ins and outs of photography and be well practiced before you practice that on someone's wedding day, because it's an event that can't be repeated. Probably the second most valuable thing would be really build your business in such a way, even in the early stages of it, to a point to where you want it to be. So that will include things like what gear to purchase, what systems you put in place, and what workflows that you might have as well, right from the capture to delivery of the photos. Having systems in place will enable you to deliver a good, consistent product. And when you do get busy, that you're across every aspect of that business. As far as a final thing, I'd probably say have every aspect of your business sort of has a common sort of voice or a common sort of message. So that comes across in your branding, your approach to photography, the way you present yourself on social media, the language that you use in emails, working with other vendors on the day, communicating with other vendors post-wedding when you send their photos. All those little bits and pieces do add up to creating a strong business and charging what you're worth. You know, a lot of people go in on selling themselves on price and to build their sort of folio. But what that does to them is they pretty much keep themselves in that sort of cheaper zone because it's harder to climb out of that zone in the long run. And you're just going to burn yourself out, because if you're trying to fill your calendar with 75 weddings a year at sort of $1,500 a piece, you're going to get to a level where, especially when it's seasonal, you're going to be working around the clock to get that workout. And my approach to business, and a lot of my peers as well, is that they'd rather charge more money and work less. You know, the old adage of work smarter, not harder type of thing, and will enable you to better service your clients. And I feel couples will value your service more when you do charge more as well.
And it's always, you know, the pricing strategy is super important, no matter whether you do headshots or weddings or something, like, you know, whatever it may be. What you'll find is, you know, depending on how you adjust your prices, you'll at the same time adjust your clientele as well. So, you know, if you're at the lower end of whatever it is that you shoot, you're going to have a particular type of client, or you'll attract a particular type of client. But the minute you change your pricing, you'll find that the type of client that you'll attract will change with it. And that's the important part to understand. And then also, of course, that has an impact on your marketing, because if you're marketing on people who are willing to spend $10,000 on a wedding, those are different people than the people that want to spend $500 on a wedding. You know, it's a completely different kettle of
fish. Yeah, and that's part of creating a sustainable business is, if you're constantly working yourself to the bone for really not much at all, after you extract your cost of doing business and your taxes on your earnings as well, your actual earnings are quite low, and you're going to get to a point where I can't do this anymore. So in order to be sustainable in this business, yeah, you do need to charge, to adequately not only pay your own way, but of course the government for taxes and the cost of doing business. And when you have to buy new camera bodies every 3 or 4 years because they break down, or, you know, invest in more and better equipment to make your job easier, such as computer systems or hard drives or whatever. All that stuff takes money. And yeah, if you're constantly working yourself to the bone for not much at all, you can't invest in those tools to make your job easier.
Learn photography, learn business, and everything else will pretty much fall into place. There's been so much amazing advice in this episode. I think it's very well worth listening to the whole thing, because I've picked up a lot of really, really amazing gold nuggets in this. So Marcel, thank you so much for being on the show today and being a guest on the Camera Shake podcast. It was great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Absolutely honored to be part of this and amongst some esteemed companies. So yeah, thank you again.
Okay, folks, that's it for today. It was phenomenal having Marcel on the show. And as always, before we go, let me just recommend another episode that I think you like. Check out episode 148 with Pai Jurser for an in-depth discussion of business essentials for photographers. I'm sure you'll love it. And if you enjoy our content, well, consider supporting us on buymeacoffee.com/camera shake to help us continue creating and bringing you more exciting episodes. It really does mean the world to us. And for those of you who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, did you know that there's a fully fledged video version over on YouTube with plenty of examples of our guest photography in full Technicolor? Well, all you have to do is go over to YouTube, search for Camera Shake Podcast, and you'll be able to watch all past episodes on there. If you're already on YouTube, however, well, drop us a comment, hit the like button, ring that bell, and share with your friends. Your engagement helps us reach a wider audience all over the world. Thank you for listening and watching, and remember, a new episode drops every Thursday, so mark that in your calendars. Till next time, keep shaking things up in the world of photography. See you next Thursday.